Welcome to Sounding Out Pedabalka. My name is Andrew Stuck from the Museum of Walking, and I am producer of Talking Walking, free podcast in which I interview artists, performers and writers who use walking as a catalyst to their creative practice. I was approached by the National Gallery to devise this participatory walk, the objective of which is to give you a better understanding of Pedabalka and specifically the effect left on him of his extraordinary journeys across Norway on foot in 1831 and 32, and how these influenced his work. I'm tackling this by inviting you to listen to four chapters of audio snippets from writers, artists, art historians, a neuroscientist, and a contemporary Norwegian commentator, intermixed with a series of creative activities that we will undertake as we walk to and around St. James's Park. There are four chapters of audio snippets, each introduced by a recording of natural ambiences typical of southern Norway. These natural ambiences also feature between the snippets. You'll know when you've reached the end of a chapter of audio snippets, as you will hear this sound. Chapter 1. Setting the Scene. Norway in the 1830s and an Introduction to Pedabalka.
Pedabalka, he was born at a time, again, of huge social and cultural change in Scandinavia, in Norway. Particularly, Norway had initially been ruled for centuries by Denmark, was then handed over during the Napoleonic European Wars to Sweden. And when Balka is a young man, the social structure of Norway is being redefined, and Norway gets its own constitution and has the most forward-thinking and radical social structure in Europe. However, Balka doesn't benefit from that initially. He's born into the landless classes. He's raised by only his mother. His father abandons the family. He is a peasant who, as a young boy, has to start working. He barely has any formal education. He has to work very much from the onset of his life, and lives in very, very harsh, very high level of poverty. He is apprenticed to a painter-decorator as a way of making a living, and that's his first introduction to painting, and the first 10 years of his painting production is that of painter-decorator. But he's clearly quite skilled, and is very quickly asked not just to, whitewash the walls, but also to create friezes and decorative effects on the increasingly large sort of farm manor houses in the Norwegian countryside.
The concentration of the population, the concentration of the institutions of culture, of government, etc., are all grouped in the south, in the area of Oslo, and that sort of corridor between Oslo in the east and Bergen in the west. But it is a very, very long, thin country heading up more or less straight north, and at the very top you see the North Cape. So if you have that notion of vast distances, and distances that become more and more difficult of access, more and more bleak and threatening even, at the further north you go, you have a sense of something, what was so interesting in Balka's work.
They had a very important shipping industry and export of timber and fish to Europe over several centuries. So that was a big industry. But then in the inland, you had all these farming communities, and there is a tradition in Norway for the farmers owning their own farm back to medieval times, the Viking times. Often even in the same families for 1,000 years, it's quite common in Norway. Travel, inland travel was very, very difficult. You could, of course, travel up the valleys because they have usually a flat bottom with a river, and then there would be roads going up the valleys. There, communication could be easier. But then, as soon as you entered the mountainous areas and the highlands, it was very difficult, and you often had to walk. So I would say that when Balki wanted to see the highlands and the mountain areas, he would like the farmers how to walk. So I would guess that he hired a local farmer who had the expertise in footpaths and in the mountains, who could assist him. Yeah, so the question is, did he follow regular routes? You know, there were routes a bit like, in England, where there were farmers who had a task of hosting travelers. You know, they have stables and mm-hmm. guest rooms for travelers. Very important, you also had the pilgrim route from Oslo to Trondheim, because St. Olav was buried in Trondheim, and that was a pilgrimage destination. And there must have been a system of inns and places for people to eat and stay on the way.
And then when Balka's walking, I don't imagine he, you know, he's not booked into anywhere to stay.
There would be nowhere to be booked into.
He's living rough and taking it as it comes.
For his initial move to Oslo, he comes into contact with a naturalist who chooses to sponsor his work. It's suggested to him that he needs to experience landscape. Like artists had done in the past, in the same way as Turner would have done, the same way as Constable would have done, he would spend, summer months doing some sketching, collecting ideas, collecting visual information, and then the winter months in the studio actually realizing these. And he undertakes a very epic journey in the summer of 1832, where he walks up towards the north coast, all the way to the Arctic Circle, and witnesses the great sights of the Norwegian landscape, including the North Cape. And it's important to remember that even today, this bit of land, a jut of very dramatic land out into the sea, is a kind of a monumental sort of symbol of the dramatic, powerful and breathtaking aesthetics of the Norwegian land. It's a destination point for tourists, and so he travels there and fills sketchbooks, but more importantly, gathers impression of what it's like to be there. Balka sort of collects on this sort of perfect idioms of dramatic landscape, including lighthouses, including important mountain peaks, the North Cape being one of them, and he repeats these same images in his painting for years and years to come.
Chapter 2, The Walking Experience.
So I had a few spare changes of clothes, getting more and more filthy and dishevelled, waterproofs. I jettisoned my gaiters pretty early on. I'd kind of thought that they would be incredibly useful, and found them a pain. They served me well in the snow, and then I got rid of them. Things I picked up, a pair of walking poles. I got an ankle injury in Germany, and the doctor recommended these things, which I'd been very sceptical of when I'd seen other people using them, but actually they really helped me. Climate and the weather are so important to the experience of walking. But actually, I mean, in terms of the weather, the snow was not the hardest. The hardest was constant rain. And yeah, the heat, I think, was a lot harder than the cold in terms of walking. As long as it was dry and cold, it was actually ideal. But as soon as I got into the proper heat of summer in the south of Europe, that's when the blisters came. Mm. That's when I was permanently sweating. That's when everything, like the straps in my bag, started really chafing my shoulders. Yeah, I think that was much harder walking conditions. Those moments of where it's a desire for wilderness, a desire to get lost and to really go beyond the ordinary landscape that you're used to. But then there was always a moment of genuine fear, which I thought was very interesting. So it felt like kind of flirting with this idea of proper wilderness. But actually when you sense what that might be like, it's scary. If something happened to me, that was really on my own. You know, there was no one about. I didn't have any equipment, no way of contacting people. No one knew where I was. Yeah, this was a kind of a recurring theme. And when I came back into civilization and safety, I was always aware of something that was something between relief and disappointment. I knew the whole point of it was to travel slowly. I knew I was in no hurry at all. It took me a long time to actually internalise that, to appreciate the act of walking for its own sake, and not just as a means of travel, but as a kind of meditation in itself. By the end, you know, I'd got quite addicted to walking as an activity. I felt good when I walked. It's a very addictive thing to do, somehow.
I think Balker's journeys would have been much more natural to him and to the world he was in than us contemplating them now. And I know that my own maternal grandparents in Wales would think nothing of walking from the town where I lived, say, about 12 miles over the hills to Neath for a day at the market or the fair and walk back over these hills again. And I think Balker's walk would not have seemed so huge to him as it might to us. But on the other hand, it's still a pretty unusual undertaking. And what's interesting is that he's clearly living rough in some quite savage places. So what gives the impetus to undertake this has to be a very powerful sense of a vocation or a vision to become a painter and to lift himself from the situation he found himself in, which would have been ground down as being at the level of a labourer, a peasant labourer pretty much, disenfranchised figure, and a way out is to undertake this pilgrimage journey in which he is going to be able to realise future art. But it's a gamble. He's investing in a future that may never arrive. And it is pretty heroic.
This wasn't a walk of rhythm and thought, but a strict regime of care and concentration, watching for the route, avoiding the catch of a crampon on an opposite gaiter. My head was bedeviled by the squint, gargoyled grins of stalactite teeth leering out of crevasses, by the image of Frankenstein and his monster wandering fog-drunk on the ice. I was in a faded black-and-white movie, where algae had coloured old snow, tinting it pink. It lay in fat slabs against the monochrome, incongruous as stakes. It was a troubled surface, holding secrets in layers and scars and curved scratches, burping up up occasional groans. It crept at its own pace, that had no need to engage with the human world or explain itself, shaping the land around it as it went. I thought of Scotland, its familiar valleys defined long ago by creatures such as this, valleys whose shape and residues still hold the mark and memory of ice. As John Ruskin said, the footmark, so to speak, of a glacier is just as easily recognisable as the trail of any well-known animal, allowing us to imagine the seas of ice which once engulfed such landscapes.
I'm not very observant when I walk in an urban setting. I'm really just going, but I find that walking can actually be quite meditative. You just get into the rhythm and you may go for an hour or whatever, but it's quite meditative. When I'm walking in a more wilderness situation or the bush, I would say that there's more of this observation, pleasure, exploratory nature to it. Although I do tend to walk quite fast and get into a meditative thing.
I set off just before 8, so it took me about 7 hours to get to where we rendezvoused. I've been trying to work it out, but it's going to be between 20 and 30 miles, I think. I've worked out, this is very interesting to me, that when I put my hand, the full span of my hand, on a 1 to 25,000 OS map, that is the distance I can walk in an hour. More or less allowing for a bit of whimsical photography and the occasional chat with someone if it was not too long, or getting a bit lost, but not all those things at once. So if I do get a bit lost, I find myself not conversing with people or not stopping. I'm a bit like my dog. I tend to be quite interested in sights and smells and sounds, and so I get rather distracted from the route. I am actually covered in some quite serious scratches. It's been quite a battle with undergrowth and overgrowth, which I suppose is a symptom of the time of year. I've been chased by bullocks. I've seen lots of butterflies and signs of wild boar.
I think that how we find our way, maybe the research we are working on. So, I mean, there are generally two ways, and those two ways work together. So the first is that for short distances, you can always use your own movement, and we actually do that to a large extent to calculate where we are in space. And that's why when you're blindfolded, you can still kind of manage your way for some meters. So this is the movement-based navigation, which works only for short distances if it's going to work on its own, because in darkness, for example, or in fog, you easily get lost in the end. And once you do an error, it goes a wrong angle, then you maintain that error all the time. So that's where the second type of navigation comes in, and that is the one that is based on landmarks, and especially visual landmarks, what you see, a valley, you see a mountain at the end, and you see a river, and so on. And so, first of all, you can use that to some extent to navigate, and you can learn how this is related to the position of the sun or whatever. And then there's memory, because finding your way is very much about memory. So when he walked there, he can keep the right direction because he sort of remembers where he comes from. And then if he walks there the first time, of course, there's no way he can find his way without asking other people. So that's just the way it is. And of course, he can learn to use the sun or the stars or whatever, but, I mean, that's not the natural way to navigate, not even for humans. So.
Uh, I've often experienced on a very long walk that when you start out, you're kind of, you know, you're very observant and you're thoughtful and you're looking at things and you're thinking of things and maybe you're thinking about how you'll describe them. But in the end, a certain point comes where you're actually, you don't do much thinking and you don't do much observing. And you're just walking, putting one foot in front of the other, and you know it's kind of a Zen thing, I guess, that you're in the moment and you're in the process. It's not about going anywhere. It's not about where you've been. It's not about how many miles you're going to cover. It's just about being into the very process of walking.
I'm not Richard Long going alone on walks for months or whatever. I have been repairing trails in Iceland, in the national parks, for a couple of years already, 5 years. So I have some kind of affinity with paths and walking. And on a personal level, I have family with English disease, rachitis. So I think I have an appreciation of the ability of walking that others maybe don't have. For me, doing this project is kind of a celebration that I'm actually physically able to walk. I don't look for the extremes. And actually, it's really hard because I'm really influenced by Richard Long and those walking artists, but you can't go one up. They've done the extremes. I mean, how can I keep on walking and be relevant to walking artists without trying to copy them? It's kind of finding my niche as well. And that's why I like to focus on the drawing as well. There is always this material residue of the walk. At this point, that's still important for me. Whereas with Richard Long, for example, it's the walking itself, the walk itself, which is the essence.
Chapter 3, Memory.
Is recording. He's not producing works on these walks. He's making a few sketches in books, but really what he's after, I think, and what he takes away and what he taps into is an emotional memory.
I would actually say that most of our memories about daily events, what was also called episodic memory, is based on our internal map of space, because we use space as a framework, and then on top of that framework we encode memories, so that you can almost not think about any single episodic memory that hasn't also a space in it. It's always tied to a location. And so, and the reason why it is like that is that the brain actually uses much of the same parts, the same cells, for encoding both space and memory. So memories are encoded on top of this spatial framework. So they're so closely tied together. And this can be used, and has been used actually since even for thousands of years, the Greeks started doing this. So what they did was that there's a phenomenon, there's a method called method of Loci, which is a memory technique where you actually, if you have lots of long lists of things to remember, you imagine you walk a path that you're familiar with, and then you plot your things to remember onto that path, and then it's so much easier to remember. So professional memorists, they actually use this technique, that they use space as a framework, then put all the things they want to remember onto places in that memory or that location, and then it's so much easier to remember.
I am warmed by midday sun. The Alec Glacier is rumbling and gurgling off into the far distance ready to carry us downhill. In a matter of weeks, the superficial imprints of the journey, bruised shins, sunburnt lips, will have healed. But I know this experience will echo on. A spell has been untied, a story retraced and given words out of silence.
Well, having seen Balker's artwork, the thing that struck me and that was very applicable to a slightly new way of writing for the book I'm working on at the moment about the Gower Peninsula is this idea that you can write about something that's way back in your memory, that you have a series of memory fields, mindscapes, that can be tapped on in an interesting way that you will not describe as fully and as detailed a way as I would if I was writing about the M25 or if I'm writing about a journey out of Epping Forest. It's not going to be like that because I don't know. I don't know the details. I've got a deeper form of topography. I've got a series of sort of archetypal images in the head which will be reaccessed to create something in a freer way that's more pared down, that relates to the kind of images I saw Balker doing at the end of his life when he wasn't producing the work to sell. He was just doing it because it was important to him to do it. And I feel that's been an example to me to move to a stage beyond the stage of doing the walks to produce books. So I had sort of three stages of walking. Originally, quite long walks undertaken to keep up the energy level for doing other things in London. And the second stage of doing shorter strategic walks that would produce books and projects. And a final stage now in which the walk is more like a reverie of things that are based on walks from a long, long time ago, which I didn't even know were going to be towards anything, but they have help to identify specific landscapes that have got heightened qualities for me.
Chapter 4, Landscape as a Trigger for Creativity.
I've always undertaken walks, sometimes for 3 or 4 days. When I first lived in London, in Hackney, I certainly made it a part of my life to undertake longer walks in the West Country, say, walk to Salisbury, Winchester, Glastonbury, all those places, on foot, not to make a written account. I wasn't doing it to do books. I was doing it to keep my consciousness high, keep things alive, and they seemed to fall at certain set times of the year. It felt very much something to do in the spring, autumn. So I just undertook those walks. I didn't really write about them. I wrote about London, but the energy to write about London came from undertaking long walks. Later, when I was more the professional writer, I'm actually now earning a living by writing, the books became the excuse for the walk. So I was looking for project walks, and this generally involved a series of shorter walks that were quite manageable. And the book would be plotted out in advance, but I wouldn't know what the actual walk would reveal. But I had now a series of techniques for how to get material out of the walk that would yield itself up as a book.
What I began to realize doing these different projects where, you know, either I was out struggling in the bush or a bunch of my friends were out struggling in the bush and I was videotaping them, was that, you know, you can look at the objects, you can look at the footage, and you can get this really romantic, beautiful idea of what's happening. But if you're physically the one that is out there doing the voyage or the walk or, you know, whatever, there's something very special that happens in that actual the group dynamics or the group of what happens there, because it is a struggle and you have to overcome certain things, but there's something about the physical act of walking mm-hmm. that is very empowering, and so that's something that I want to begin to try and expand on.
What I have discovered is that if I don't take notes, I don't observe as well. And, of course, there's this funny thing that happens with note-taking and memory where once you've written it down, you kind of almost don't need to refer to the note because it is somewhere in your brain. But I've realised that the walks I've done when I didn't know I was going to write about it and I didn't take notes were very much harder to write about afterwards because the quality of the observation wasn't as sharp in my memory. The walking has quite a lot of different functions in writing, actually, because I certainly use it quite deliberately as a way of getting to know a place that I'm writing about. I had a novel which came out last year called Call of the Undertow, which is set on the north coast of Caithness. I really did use walking there as a way of getting the story, because the place has a lot of stories existing, and by walking there, I felt I was kind of familiarising myself with the stories, but also the characters started to emerge out of it. The other thing that walking does is it allows me to have this slightly unfocused way of thinking. So I can be observing a bit of what's around me, I can be observing a bit of what's going on in my head, and somewhere between the two, if I've got a problem in my writing, something which hasn't been coming, if I've been working already that day on it, usually the solution will come when I go for a walk.
I do it for the pleasure of walking, but it's also part of the process of writing that there's something about the pace of walking that it gives you just enough time to be able to think and to... you start to walk, the blood starts to flow. I think that a bit of blood flowing around the brain is probably good for creativity and for having ideas.
Well, I have been making art in the landscape, and I started, like, the initial impulse was the fact that a picture was not really transmitting what I felt when I looked into the landscape or when I experienced the landscape. That started in Iceland, actually, and the sublimity of the landscape there, I just didn't find it back in my pictures, so I was looking for a more tactile way to interact with the landscape. So I rubbed my sketchbook that I brought against the different places that I visited. And this is kind of the next step. I'm currently reloading my shoes. I put canvas under them, and I make drawings of the path by walking it. And the path will leave traces on the canvas on my shoes. Well, yesterday was a long day. It was 30K, and I made 7 drawings. So that's 14 pieces of canvas, one for the left foot, one for the right foot. So now I'm kind of using canvas under my shoes. And now, I can draw as I go along, really. The walking itself, the activity, is an essential part of this work. But basically I'm making a drawing, so it can be shown in a gallery or whatever. Yeah, I tend to prefer the linear thing because it is a path and I want to show people that I walked it from the beginning to the end. And the image they have to go home with, I would like it to be kind of a pixelated blur of grey and green and maybe some certain kind of brown. And let them go home with the purity of the concept. Yeah. Okay, he walked that path. They don't have to know about all the practical stuff.
it was rather like this, that I'd accessed in early walks and journeys, which had to be taken, materials that could then be written about many, many years later. And the inspiration was looking at the late Balkas, the little chunks of wood that actually I think were part of houses. Mm-hmm. He'd actually used the wood that was part of the projects he was working on, and was so free. Well, now I felt, because I'm trading in memory, I could write in a sense with that kind of way, using that as inspiration, and place the three walks as a portrait of a life, a kind of autobiography, by way of the way you would look at a landscape that hadn't changed that much, with some of the oldest and fiercest and most dramatic rock forms in Britain. And suddenly you're looking at some essence of it that is also a part of you. A stage beyond it is a kind of hybrid between literature and image, and very distinctly about memory, which was what my project became. I called it Stone Footing in Memory Fields because it was about interrogating your own memory by setting it against a very specific landscape that had to be walked, or had to become part of a difficult journey. And I thought the epic journeys on foot that Balkas did early on, searching for motifs that would be brought back, this whole process of coming back into the sacred space of the studio where you are interrogating yourself and your deepest impulses to make the work that can be shown from that, depends upon those two things. And the boat trip is more like a sort of reverie. And it's almost posthumous. You're in somewhere that things you should only see after you've died. The landscapes are so far from the human. They're post-human. And when you look at the paintings on the wall there's also a fine series of hairline cracks in the painting, which add to the surface as if the materials of the paint and the canvas or the wood are interacting in a way to do something that's beyond the landscape, beyond the painter. It is a very special zone of interrogation that requires that pilgrimage-like state to get at it. And it might be the walking that goes on in southern Norway, or the walk that he makes to go all the way to Stockholm, or it might be this journey by water.